Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Simone Riscala, and you are listening to the Endow Podcast, a conversation not just about the feminine genius in general, but about cultivating your particular feminine genius through the Catholic intellectual tradition and intentional community. Well, hello, Endow ladies. I'm so happy to have Emily Stinson Chapman with me today, who is the author of, I'm going to hold this up, 6 of our studies. This is it. This is the Emily collection. So thank you, Emily, for being with me today.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so happy to see your face, Simone.
Thank you, Emily. Last time we talked, it was on Instagram Live, which goes away in 24 hours. So now
we keep... That was like right before the world went insane. Wasn't that like a week or something before everything went wacky?
Yes, it was. It was the last time we saw each other, not in person, but our faces. Not through social media stuff. So anyway, I'm glad that we'll have this for longer than 24 hours. But I wanted to talk to you today about all of your studies, whatever you can remember about the experience of the text, of writing it, your journey through them, and then why Endow women out there should study these texts. So if you don't mind, this is on kind of on the spot. If we can blow through 6 studies, 5 minutes of study, if you're up for it.
With the caveat that everyone knows I wrote every single one of those studies, like while we were going through a major house renovation, while we were going through crazy adoptions, while I had newborn babies. I wrote Hildegard when we had a brand new baby and I was like, why could they not have given me St. Therese? Like, do I have to have an obscure medieval mystic to write about with a newborn baby when I'm sleeping 4 hours a night? So yeah, we will see together what I remember about what I wrote for you. I love going back through the studies because I'm like, oh, I wrote that? Oh, that's good. I don't remember writing that.
Oh my gosh, exactly. You're like, hey, not this is good. That's not so bad. I love that. And I didn't even introduce who you are because I just assume everybody knows who you are. But I'm going to give you something maybe is not in your official biography, which is that you make it very hard to leave social media, Emily, because we're all on there. You know, I try to be charitable. There's bumper sticker Christianity. And then there's like Emily's social media stuff where you're like, oh yeah, aww, the nitty gritty, the real deal. And it's such a help to me and such a help to so many of our friends and our Catholic community. So thank you for helping us so much and sharing your life with us. So do you want to briefly introduce yourself? I feel so silly doing it. She writes a lot of books.
I'm a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a writer. I married late in life, so I had lots of time to do writing before babies started coming along. So I've got, I don't know, a lot of books now, half a dozen books. I've got the Endow studies, I've got some Bible studies. I have a new book coming out this summer that everybody's going to hate. It's basically, the working title is Letters to Myself from the End of the World. And I've been joking, like, you know, Rachel Hollis's book, Girl, Wash Your Face.
I do.
This is not that book. This is like, girl, get to confession. Girl, go to mass. It's a lot of, you know, strong spiritual maturity stuff, lessons that I've learned the hard way over the past 20 years of being a Catholic and writing about the faith. So yeah, so that's the new book that'll be coming out. But you know, I mostly just change poopy diapers right now and chase toddlers. And that's mostly what I do.
I can't wait to read it because I think I kind of am tired of the whole like, well, at least we're planting seeds and it's time to be mature, intentional disciples, shall we?
Yeah. I mean, I just don't think that given the state of the world, there's nothing else that's going to make an improvement. Like if we don't grow up in the faith, if we don't become more mature, we can't expect, like, it's because that's how we're responding to people and how we're loving people and how we're witnessing on social media to people and the ability to turn the other cheek and to bear wrongs patiently and to love the unlovable. Like that's what is going to change the world. So I'm trying to put whatever wisdom I have into the book, and the babies are making it hard to finish it. COVID is making it hard to finish it. But it is coming. So
it will come. Well, I look forward to it. Very much. Okay. So I'm just going to pick one. Well, your most recent is the Rosary. And that's actually the study that we talked about last time. So in you know, just to tell us your experience of, well, I know reading John Paul II's letter on the rosary was helpful for your conversion. I remember that part of our conversation that you, and you started praying the rosary every day, every morning because of it.
Right. I started praying the rosary every morning and praying it a little differently, like just realizing that there was freedom in the prayer. I didn't have to like do this set of rosary mysteries on this day and this set on this day, that if it's the Feast of the Nativity, I can meditate on nothing but the Nativity for five mysteries, and that I could go deeper, and that the rosary was, John Paul II calls it the school of Mary. Yeah. So it's not a rote prayer. It's not like, it's meant to be a meditation, and it's meant to lead you to seeing Jesus and seeing the gospel through Mary's eyes. It's really a lesson in prayer. It helps us, it takes us through all the different types of prayer, through vocal prayer, through meditative prayer, into contemplative prayer. And that's what the study is really about. People think, oh, I'm going to learn about the mysteries of the rosary or the prayers of the rosary. And we talk about that, but much more fundamentally, I try to get into the church's rich teaching on prayer and what John Paul II is talking about when he calls us, what is meditation? What is contemplation? What are the different, you know, how should a spiritually mature Christian be praying? How do we learn how to pray that way? And all of that is packed into the rosary. That's why John Paul II says it's the church's most fundamental prayer besides the Mass. And so, it's really a study about prayer and spiritual maturity as practiced through the rosary. The rosary is the door you go into to go deeper into being with the Lord and talking to the Lord and just contemplating his life.
How do you feel about the idea of like just fitting the rosary into your day? Because that idea of the rosary as being a doorway into meditative and contemplative prayer is very different than sometimes the attitude we see with certain Catholics. And I think what our Protestant brothers and sisters sometimes see about like, you're just rattling off prayers, you're distracted, you're just trying to fit it in, you're doing other things while you're praying it, which I think is fine sometimes. But you know, that's a very different, very intentional way to enter into the rosary. That's different than just like getting it checked off your list.
Right. And I think it's like a relationship. Okay. So my husband and I sometimes don't have a lot of time to be together. And the best we can do is, good night. I love you before we fall asleep at night. Life is so busy and so full. And other times we can sit and we can talk with each other and we can look at each other and we can hash out, you know, our days and just really be together, like contemplate each other. And I think the rosary is like that. So there's going to be times where you've been going nonstop with a kid from morning till night, or there's deadlines and you literally cannot fit in an hour for deep contemplation. I used to be able to do that a lot more when I was single. Now that there's babies and somebody's always awake, whether it's day or night, that doesn't happen. So there's times where the rosary at night in bed before you fall asleep is just saying, I love you, Lord. I love you, Mary. Like, you have my heart, even though all of the
I'm here with you.
I love you. Like, I love you, Lord. Yeah. And then there's times where when we can, we make the time to sit down and pray it in the quiet, very focused. And that's obviously what you want to do as much as possible. But our relationship with the Lord is a balance, just like every other relationship. And what he wants is our hearts, and we give it to him the best way we can. So
pray as you can and not as you can't.
Yes. So. Or else I would never pray some days.
I love that. That's very normal, very reasonable. And I think it can help, because there is sometimes this tendency to compare our prayer lives with other people's prayer lives and not stop and look at the Lord first and look at the reality of our lives first. It's easy to be judgmental, and it's also easy to kind of fall into a lack of freedom. If the rosary isn't giving me freedom, then that the relationship needs to be like, we need to have a face-to-face conversation, right? Because fall asleep playing and saying, my heart is here, I love you, even though I'm not really focused, I'm distracted, is very different than just check, I did it, you know, and never getting to that point where there's like actual communion and connection and intimacy and like that face that you were talking about. Moving on. Let's see. This is fun. I'm having fun. Let's do St. Catherine.
That's my favorite. It's my favorite
of all of them.
It's my favorite of all of them. I love it so much.
I love
her so much.
I love this study. It was so fun. So good. So it's your favorite. Why is it your favorite? Because St. Catherine is just the best. Because she's the best.
She has such a great story. I love telling stories. Like, I love to be able to tell stories. And so getting the chance to tell St. Catherine's story and what a fascinating and wild and crazy life she had. It was so full of surprises and real moments. Like, it's easy to over-spiritualize St. Catherine, because she is a super holy, levitating, schismatic, or not schismatic, stigmatic, you know, she has the stigmatism. She's a stigmatic. How do I say it? Last night I made up a new word for my husband. I was trying to say trajectory or direction. I said trajection, which I think is a great word. So I'm going to start using trajection more. I shouldn't call St. Catherine a schismatic though.
But, schismatic, stigmata. Yeah, we could write a poem about this.
My boys aren't sleeping. You shouldn't trust anything I say right now. She also has these real honest moments with the Lord that are exactly what we're called to imitate. Where there was one time, one of my favorite stories, she had been just being hounded by demons like day and night in her parents' room. And the demons go away and Jesus comes back. And she's like, okay, Jesus, where were you? Like, what's up? I've been attacked by hordes of demons for days and you're just like, what, hanging out someplace talking to some other mystic? Where have you been? And and I love the honest, and he has a great response to her that you should read the study to find out. But I love her honesty with the Lord. It is such a relationship. And so to look at her as a model of what it means to love Jesus, how to talk to him, how to serve him, how to be focused on him, and how that translates into how you're loving others and serving others. But yeah, we're all called to love Jesus like she loved him and to love others like she loved him in our own way, in given our state in life, given the graces we're given. And so I loved being able to dig deeper into her life and her teaching, which is, I keep quoting her again and again in the book that I'm finishing up right now. And I'm like, I should just be telling people to go read the Endow study on St. Catherine. Like, go read that. But there's so much wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah, read both.
And she's just awesome. But then the nitty gritty, like the holiness that fed into that was really like the nitty gritty of like loving that person you don't like. And is actually, I really appreciated the detraction, all the gossip and being called a witch and, you know, all of that, because there's can be so prevalent in certain church cultures and in certain
communities. Well, and holiness is weird. You know, holiness is different. Holiness is not doing what other people do. And it can be hard to understand. People don't understand, like, why is she being so good to me? Why is she being so nice to me? Yeah. I loved how her brothers and sisters had to lock up all their possessions because she kept giving everything in the house to the poor. It was like, if you like that, you better put it under lock and key or Catherine's taking it. Holiness is hard. And the fact that we think holiness is some sort of easy peasy, pie in the sky, floaty, lovely thing, it just shows how little actual holiness we're exposed to. And Catherine brings that home. Like, if you're going to be holy, if you're going to love the Lord like that, people are not going to get you. You're not going to be saying what the world is saying. You're not going to be doing what the world is doing. And so you're going to suffer. And how are you going to suffer? Like, this is how Catherine suffered. And this is how she bore those wrongs. And I think there's just a lot for us to learn from her. She's so relevant, even though she lived 600 years ago, 700 years ago.
So relevant. I think definitely in our challenging time, we need her.
Yes.
Yeah. I
in these dark and difficult times, Catherine is helpful.
People are so mean to her. I mean, it's almost like the spirit of Catherine is it was of no consequence almost. Like it wasn't, her and Jesus seemed to be so tight that it was like, oh, yeah, people just beat me up. Okay.
I know. They kick me in the street. They say I'm a whore. Like, whatever. I love Jesus. Yeah. I don't handle things like her. So I am not Catherine.
She's coming up. So I hope that lots of women do it. I love that. I love that study. Okay. Let's see. Next one. Letter to women. Shall we?
My first one I did for Endow. Yes.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. We just finished this up with our online Letter to Women webinar and it was so good. Such a good study. We have a nice collection of studies, but if our only apostolate was getting this into the hands of women out there, I think that could be a huge, huge game changer.
Yeah.
So How was that experience of this, the first study that you did for Endow?
It was such an honor to get to do that study. That letter, John Paul II's letter to women, and then Mulieris Dignitatum were so fundamental in my own just coming to understand what it meant to be a woman. The National Catholic Register had asked me to write an op-ed for them on the anniversary of this letter, which was, I'm bad at math. It was a big anniversary this year of that letter, or last year of that letter. Like the 25th anniversary. Yeah,
1995. I can't do math either. We're theology people, Emily.
1995 to 2020. That's like the 25th anniversary.
Okay, great. We can do it.
I know. Never trust my numbers. So it was the 25th anniversary and they asked me, and I thought back to when I was in college, and I remember very distinctly walking across campus and asking myself, what does it mean to be a woman? Which tells you what kind of college student I was. Like, I'm not thinking about like what party am I going to, where I was like, what does it mean to be a woman? Because I was so confused. I had always grown up with these messages that a woman could do anything that a man can do, that there was no difference between a woman and a man. And then I was looking at the culture around me that was telling me women were supposed to be sexy and women were supposed to be desirable, and that was the measure of femininity. And I was really confused, and I wrestled with that for a number of years. I struggled with an eating disorder partly because of that, because I decided that to be a woman meant to be thin. I was like, okay, I can be thin.
Right.
I can't hide my opinions. I can't be not intelligent, but
right.
I can be skinny.
Yeah.
So when I came across John Paul II's letter to women, and I found him describing the feminine genius and the call to spiritual motherhood and what spiritual motherhood meant, I was so freed by that. Like, it wasn't about how I looked or what I did for a living. It wasn't about, you know, anyone else's expectations of me other than God, and this call to love people where they were, to see them, to see what made them special, to see what made them unique, and to help draw out those gifts and just let them know that they were seen and loved. I was like, oh, I can do this. Okay, yeah, this is great.
I was trying to do this. Yeah, I was meant to do this. Yeah.
Exactly. So being able to walk through that letter and just help women see that freedom that the church is trying to give them, and that, you know, what they think the church means by being a woman is not really what the church means. So many people are always trying to say that the church's understanding of the feminine genius or spiritual motherhood or being a woman is confining or limiting. And if you don't measure up, if you don't have six kids and a minivan and stay at home, or if you,
you know,
aren't a nun, that you're not feminine. And that's not the case. And the church doesn't say, the church just offers so much freedom.
This is why studying documents of the church is so crucial, because there's so much bad marketing and bad PR out there on the church, but so few of the people who say those kind of things have actually read what the church is about anything. So there's this, like, you know, meeting so many ex-Catholics or just like women who are somehow used to have some sort of form of Catholic identity. They don't even know Letter to Women or Mulieris Dignitatum even exists. Mm-hmm. They don't know the church has anything to say about women. And then for those of us who are in the church, these documents are so little studied. They're not really studied in seminary, as far as I'm aware of. They're not studied. They're not taken seriously. Yeah. And they ought to be, because if we really believe that women are the cultural game changers, which John Paul II said they were, and many other saints like Fulton Sheen, then that would mean that maybe we would want to take a look at these documents, both men
and maybe actually see what the church says, and not what like the random guy at the, you know, schismatic church says about women. Yeah, just maybe. That would be helpful.
We're really praying for more opportunities for Letter to Women to get on college campuses, because that is the young adult, just like you were saying, you know, you're in college, you're wondering what it means to be a woman. This is the time to get Letter to Women into the hands of college students that Catholic colleges are not. And I know my former high school students who have done Letter to Women in their freshman year, they were like, Grace was bouncing off the pages. Like, that was their word. So, you know, that's a...
It's the antidote to all the lies about women coming at us from the culture and all the things that cause confusion and comparison and just measuring yourself against what the internet says you should be or who this other woman at the school says you should be. And God just becomes the measuring stick, and you realize that He made you to be you, and He's given you a call and equipped you to do that call in a way that nobody else is. And so
yeah,
I just keep coming back to freedom. There's so much freedom in the church's teachings about women, and I just want to shout them from the rooftop. So yeah. I got to shout them a bit. in that study.
You did. And it's so fruitful. I love him. Before we move on to the next study, I just have to give another shout out to John Paul II, who you, in a generation without husbands, without fathers, without uncles, without brothers, being unprotected, women being so unprotected because of the effects of the sexual revolution. I just feel like John Paul II is like my friend. He's a man and a spiritual father who's got my back, you know? Yeah. And I think he can, he's obviously done that for so many people, both men and women, but for those who've yet to encounter him, especially a woman and a young adult in a deeper way, this is the study. He's on our team. He's on our side.
I know he is. Yes. I feel so blessed that I'm old enough to have like remember his papacy. And I came back to the faith in the last year of the Great Jubilee of 2000, which he'd called. So I always feel like John Paul II called me home that year.
He called you home.
So I know.
Talking about some spiritual fatherhood, which led to your own spiritual motherhood for so many women and so many people. But yeah, it kind of broke my heart when I was a high school teacher. You know, I had John Paul II up on my wall, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, and they would look at John Paul II and go, "Oh, I know that guy. I've seen that guy around. I didn't know who he was." So I'm like, oh no, if you're in a Catholic school, in a really good Catholic school, might I add, and you don't know who John Paul II is, I think that week I bought like 100 some copies of Jason Everett's, you know, his little mini Witness to Hope, you know,
it's not a doorstop. Yeah,
exactly. And it just like started passing them out to my students. I'm like, Christmas gifts for Miss Riz, because you've got to know who John Paul II is. You just have
to
know.
Oh my goodness.
But there are a lot of generations that don't. So another part of the mission. All right. Next study, discovering the doctors.
Oh yeah. That was the post Toby study. That was the, I have a newborn and I'm writing about obscure medieval visions of a beast being the church being raped. That was.
So this, I remember your social media at that time, and you were like, I don't know that Hildegard and I would be friends. I mean, I love and respect her, but I don't know that we would be like besties. Is that true? Still true, Emily?
Because we're too much alike. I mean, girl was, okay, I'm gentler than Hildegard. She makes me look like a little lamb. Girl was, she was bossy, man. Like she was bossy and outspoken, and she got what she wanted. She knew how to, I love, you know, there's all these stories about her getting sick when the monks aren't giving her way. Yes. And she takes to bed because she's sick. And then the monks decide to give her way and she leaps out of bed and everyone gazes on in amazement. I'm like, you do know she's playing you, right? Like, do you know she's playing you? I mean, maybe not. Maybe I'm going to get to heaven if I get to heaven and Hildegard's going to be like, I was really sick. Yeah. But it's hard not to.
Friends. Yeah.
I'm like, what a coincidence, Hildegard. But what I loved the most about her, she reminds me in a sense, in a completely, let me explain. So she reminded me a little bit of Kristin Lovren's daughter, the novel by Sigrid Undset. So I didn't like Kristin for the first like 2.5 of the 3 books. I thought her very silly. She was always fainting and sleeping with the wrong guy, and she annoyed me a lot. But by the time you got to the plague, things really picked up, and Kristin had changed. She'd become this mature, wise woman who you're like, oh, this is what grace does over the course of a life. Like it takes this silly, flighty, foolish girl and transforms her into a holy, loving, generous woman. And that's really what you see over the course of Kristin Lovren's daughter. And for me, that's what I saw with Hildegard, where over the course of her life, God gave her these amazing visions all of her life. She had these great graces, but she was, she ticked a lot of people off. She was not always going about things in the best possible way. She was accomplishing so much. You know, she's writing books about healing, and she's writing music, and she's writing plays, and she's writing these huge books of visions, and the Pope is reading. But she personally was at times difficult to like. But you get to the end of her life, and this new secretary comes to help her out, and he's heard all the horror stories about Hildegard, you know, how she just, she's such a terror. And he meets her and he's like, oh my gosh, she is a loving mother and everyone here adores her. She was in her 80s by that point. But like Kristin, grace had perfected her. And it was her continually serving God when she didn't want to. Like she didn't want to write those visions. She wanted to make her medicines and write her music and run her convent. She didn't want to have to be going all over Europe doing all of these different things. But her obedience to what God was asking her to do became a source of grace to her. And so by the end of her life, I was like, oh, I would like to be like that. I would like to be like Hildegard. <Yeah. laughs>
Keep pushing forward despite my foibles and just
right.
Let grace do its thing, get my ego out of it, you know?
And yeah, so by the end, I loved Hildegard, and now I love that study. And but I had to work through my own feelings about, and I was super tired and taking care of a newborn and reading obscure medieval visions, trying to make them accessible to people.
I think this is why your social media is so fun. I love being on the journey with you because I'm like, yeah, you know what? I do need a real moment. Emily just made it real today, and I'm on that. You know, no pretending things are fine. They're not fine. So I think it was fun to see that writing. I know it was torturous for you. Some of my happy achievements in life have, I guess this is stereotypical, but yeah, I've come through a lot of torture and I'm just like, Lord, why? Why is this? Why do I have to do this right now?
Yeah. But Hildegard's not just about Hildegard. I mean, the doctor study, there's also, we talk about all of the doctors in the church. We talk about what it means to be a doctor. Yeah. So it's kind of, you get two studies in one, really. We didn't feel like we had enough to do a whole study on the doctors. So we did a short, you know, the first three lessons are on the doctors of the church, and then the last five are on Hildegard, who you could have done 10 studies on if you wanted to.
Right, right. I love that it has all the doctors because it's just a nice survey of, and then you can go deeper with, you know, maybe there's a doctor of the church in there that really strikes you or that's calling your name, and you can then go start reading them and investigating and going more deeply into their life. So I love that. All right, let's see. Humanae Vitae.
Yes.
I love this study. And you know what? I know endows for women, but I want this in high schools. I think high school students, as a former high school teacher, I want high school students to be doing this. I do.
No, it's just good stuff. I mean, it's good stuff to know. And we talk about, you know, so a little insight into where I was when I was doing that one, because it always comes across. So, it's a real person writing those studies. So even though I'm explaining what the church says, so we were really at the height of our struggle with infertility when I was writing that. And I felt like God was not being nice to me when Martha, I was supposed to be doing a different study for you. And Martha's like, oh no, wait, who was the president of Endow at the time? She's like, wait, we have to switch. We need you to do Humanae Vitae. Next year's the anniversary of Humanae Vitae. And I'm like, you want me to talk to a bunch of fertile Catholic women about openness to life when I'm just desperately doing anything right now, you know, within the church's teachings to get pregnant. I didn't really feel like giving women a pep talk about being open to life at that point. So I was pretty mad when I sat down to write that study. And it was such an amazing grace to me, Simone, because as I was writing it, I was realizing how much, one, that openness to life means a lot of things. You know, it's not just yes to every baby God gives me, but it's yes to all life, like yes to the life that comes into my home, yes to welcoming people. Yes to trusting God's plan for my fertility. Like trusting God, really trusting God with your fertility doesn't just mean trusting when babies come. It means trusting when they don't come. It means trusting when they don't come on your timeline. It means trusting him with your marriage and your reputation and your professional life and your finances. Like there's so much that goes into it. And by diving into that document, which talks about marriage and trust and what it means to be a family, I received a lot of healing from just the wounds from infertility that had left on me. And it helped us, I think the very week I sent that study off to you, we got asked to adopt our first son, Toby.
Wow.
And yeah, so for me, I feel like I was in a place where we could say yes very freely to that child, like without it being about my infertility, about being open to God's plan and this child and this baby. And I don't know if I would have been able to do that without having done the Humanae Vitae study.
Wow. That is an incredible story. Had no idea, Emily. That is amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah. So I always get more out of the studies than anyone. Like I get more out of them than anybody when I write them.
I think this is God's little like trick or secret handshake. I just did a talk on leisure and I was like, ha ha, Lord, I see what you're trying to tell me about my life. Like, you know, like it's for the people. Yeah, right. It's for me.
Yeah. Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah. My mom's so brutal. She's a Hildegard type. She's like, you're doing a talk on leisure. Why don't you just live leisure? I was like, thanks, Mom. So she's just always keeping it real, but I love it. I just love it. It's, I love the truth, lover of truth, lover of reality, humbling as it is. We have Laura, our director of content tonight. We have a little, you know, our little work, you know, because we're, you know, work, you know, your days never go as anybody plans ever, you know, but when there are those moments where you're like, I really wanted this to go as I wished and it just didn't, we hearken to St. Faustina's line, humility is my daily bread.
Yes, I should have that emblazoned, like, stenciled around my walls at this point. So.
Wish we had a buzzer, like, just like. Humility is my daily bread moment. Anyway, all right. Last study is Salve Beach Dolores, which so happy about this one because I hear this is so many people's favorite study because it just brings so much healing in the study. And infertility is one of those issues that keeps coming up and it's been such a source of healing, but so many other things too, loss of parents and all of the various suffering. So do you remember what your experience was like writing this one?
I mean, that's what I wrote during the house renovation when I was like in an attic unheated while there's saws going off all around me. And yeah, every one of these studies is attached to a very vivid moment in my life. They're like deeply personal to me. So I think of dust and dirt and noise when I think of self-achieved Dolores. But no, it's, like I've been very blessed in life, but I've also had, you know, I've also had my crosses in terms of waiting so long to get married. I didn't get married till I was 41. I would have liked to have been married at, I don't know, 21. So those years of loneliness, our struggle to conceive, not being able to conceive, and just your normal, I'm my own cross, like my mouth. I say things I shouldn't say. I do things I shouldn't do. I am my own worst cross, as most of us are. And in all those years of praying through the suffering that, you know, I was going through or that I was causing myself, I was so blessed to dive into the church's teachings on suffering. I found so much comfort in the fact that there was actually a way to think through these things and to experience them in a way that united me to Christ. And so being able to dive into, all right, like, here's this answer, and here's this answer, and here's this answer, and this can help you understand what's going on, but what you really need to do is just look at Jesus on the cross. And you don't have to have all the answers to why you're suffering or why suffering happens. You just have to look at Jesus. And if you can see him suffering and know that he's suffering with you, like, you can get through this. Like, that's all you ultimately need to know, is to see Jesus on the cross, loving you and with you in your, as you carry your cross or hang on your cross. And so being able to dive into that in the midst of the mess that we were, you know, was going on, was a real gift.
Yeah. I think that's very different than, I think it takes a lot of courage to do the suffering study one, because you're going to have to confront things that you've maybe like shoved away. That will just force its way out from being confronted in the cross study. But I think also that Jesus is suffering with you. So it's not, because you hear this too, kind of in church cultures, like, we'll just kind of suck it up and just be quiet about it. And I think that is not the recommendation of any of our tradition, right? It's a real, again, back to, it's a real relationship. Yeah. It doesn't mean you just pretend the suffering isn't there or just slap a Jesus bumper sticker on top of it and call it good. Right. And other people,
no toxic positivity, that kind of stuff. Like, you don't have to pretend everything is fine. You can suffer. It is. Jesus suffered. Yeah. Mary suffered. You can suffer. Like, and that's okay.
That's ultimate judgment. There's glory in that. So there's redemption. I mean, I think that's right in that suffering. There's beauty in there. And that is really different than the secular world. I mean, really, really different. And during all this, you know, COVID things and all the way that people have been handling it and mental illness going through the roof and all of this stuff, there's just certain people in my life that I'm thinking about who I would really love to propose the meaning of suffering to them in a way to make their load lighter. Because when you have meaning behind it, it does help you walk through that. And carry
and them. When you just know it's going to happen, like my sister, I love my sister. She's a hypochondriac. She will tell you she's a hypochondriac. She's always worried she has cancer or a tumor or some strange disease. And she's calling me up to talk about it. And we're getting to the age now, you know, she's like 42. And I was like, okay. And you realize at some point, something is actually going to be wrong with you. Okay. Yeah. Like, unless you die in a car accident tomorrow, like something is going to be wrong with you or wrong with your children. And you have to be, you have to stop being so afraid of this that it's sending you to a panic every time. Like I expect to suffer lots more before I die. I was like, oh Lord, what are you going to do to me next? Like, what's going to happen? What cross is going to come my way as you try to make me holy? It's not that you're comfortable with suffering, because suffering is never comfortable. Suffering is heart-wrenching, but that you're not surprised when it happens to you, and you just accept it. Like Jesus walked towards his cross. You realize that you don't have to like it. You don't have to be doing backflips about it. Yeah. But there's no other way to get to Jesus without the cross. Like, that's it. Like, if we are going to get to heaven, we have to follow in his footsteps, and we are going to suffer. And so to know that him at the end, like him on the other side and him with you as you're suffering, like it makes the suffering worth it. And knowing that you can offer that suffering for other people to get them to Jesus helps make it endurable.
Yeah.
You have to be able to talk yourself through it and just know what you're going towards, even though what you're going through is difficult.
Yes. And I think the danger of not having cultivated, or at least on the path to cultivating, a close relationship with Jesus is that we hold on to sufferings that were not necessarily ours, crosses that not necessarily ours, but situations that can be healed and restored by prayer, calling down the Holy Spirit and all that kind of stuff. So what we're talking about is like the legitimate crosses that are right. All the other stuff. As I'm hearing this, I'm thinking, okay, cause someone can be listening to this and say like, okay, well, I just accept all these dysfunctional toxic relationships, cause that's the Christian thing to do, or, you know, whatever situation I'm in, I guess that's my cross. And that's not what's being said. What's being said is of the legitimate crosses that Jesus himself is accompanying you through, right? All the other stuff, you know, there's still healing and restoration for all the unnecessary stuff. So I think that's always important to talk about.
When you're talking about, because everyone at some point loses someone they love, like death is inevitable.
Right.
That is something you have to walk through.
Can't control that one.
Everyone gets sick in some way. Like we all, and even though there might be healing, even though there's medicine that we know we want to do what the Lord has given us to get better, but better doesn't always happen. And even as you're journeying through that, that's hard. Like chronic illness is hard. Chronic pain is hard. Acute illnesses are hard, and they don't just go away.
Healing, advocating, you know, praying for healing, praying for all these kind of things. And God might intend to allow that healing, but it's still sometimes on his timeline. So it's not, you know, you got to stay in the game. I'm just thinking.
I've been blessed with two beautiful boys. You know, we're hopefully adopting a third baby in a few months.
Ordinarily cute, by the way.
They're so cute. I know. God, they're so beautiful. But that didn't make infertility. Like, looking back now where I'm at with these beautiful boys, I would go through it all again to get to them. Like, it was all worth it to be Toby and Beckett's mother. But that didn't make the infertility at the time any easier. Like, I knew God had a plan. I knew I needed to trust him, but that was excruciating when you feel like your body is failing you, and you're failing your husband, or you're failing, you know, you're just failing.
You're like a failure. Like, you literally cannot see.
Right. I didn't know Toby and Beckett were there waiting for me. Like, I didn't know I would have sweet little toddler arms, you know, to snuggle up with. And so you don't know what's on the other side, but you know, Jesus is with you, and you know that if you can unite your suffering to his, that's going to draw you closer to Jesus, and that's going to draw other people closer to Jesus. And so it's a way of making sense of suffering and making it through the suffering, because it does end. Like, well, if you don't go to hell, it ends. So it's a good reason not to go to hell.
Oh gosh. Yes.
I don't know.
Emily.
That's a cheerful thought.
This is awesome. So thank you for like breezing through these studies. I think this is such great history, so incarnational, just seeing, you know, your relationship with the studies as you were writing them. Is there anything else that you would like to encourage endow women and the intellectual life, and, you know, discipleship? Any last wise words?
Oh, just drink coffee. I don't know. I'm so tired. that's what I want to do right now. I want to drink coffee. No, I think what I love about the endow studies, and that I was given the opportunity to do, is balance head and heart. Looking at the church teachings, you're looking at what reason, what reason helps us see about the faith. Like, the faith is eminently reasonable, and there are good reasons why we believe what we believe, but it's also a relationship. And there's times where we don't know and we don't understand, or where we have to look at ourselves, and it doesn't matter how much we know in our head. We have to examine our hearts. We have to figure out where we're broken. We have to figure out where we have to let grace in. And the Endowed Studies enabled me to do that. So I could talk about, you know, this intense theology, but then ask questions or bring it home for people in a way that they were able to connect that with, okay, well, where do I need to grow? Where am I struggling? Where have I failed or been failed in a way that's affecting my relationship with Christ? And I think the Endowed Studies do that in a way that other studies don't, with the heavy intellect, but also the heavy heart, heavy relationship aspect.
I love that. Thank you, Emily. And I'm praying for you. I know that what the women listening to this are praying for you, excited for the next baby, the next step, and all the joy.
We're hoping this next one's supposed to be a girl. So
yes, you know. So if you're listening to this and you get to this end of this podcast or interview, please pray for Emily and her family and baby girl. Any name?
The babies. Yeah. So pray for the birth mother, please, yeah. Because she struggles a lot and this is very hard on her and she just needs a lot of prayers and a lot of graces. So please pray for her, pray for strength and wisdom and all that. Yeah. And then for baby girl, yes, her name is Eleanor Rose Collette.
Oh, so, my gosh. Great name.
Yeah. So Ellie. Pray for Ellie. The birth mother has asked that we name her early. She did the same thing with Toby. They have the same birth mother.
That's so neat. Yeah. That she asked for that. Yeah, I love her. Right.
Eleanor Rose Collette, baby Ellie. Pray for her health. Pray for her safety. It's a very high risk pregnancy in every possible way in terms of the baby's health and the mother's health. So really, lots of prayers would be appreciated. So.
We will storm heaven for you and rooting for you.
Thanks. And then I can get some work done. That would be good. Yes.
Might as well, while that happens. When I saw the post, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm definitely going to be praying. And it was so much excitement. So
I know. It's so blessing to have. It's just such a blessing to have so many people excited for us and praying for us. So we're super grateful for that.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Emily. And I hope it'll be sooner next time I see you. And maybe
you come visit us. You know that. You could come visit the baby.
I know. I cannot wait for this. I'm near my parents. I live near my parents who are immunocompromised, but I can't wait to start traveling again. And I'm going to come visit you for sure. So
yeah, you're welcome anytime.
Thank you, Emily.
If this episode was helpful for you, I would love it if you'd share it with your friends. I would also love to hear your comments and feedback. So please email me at simone.riscala@endowgroups.org, or feel free to reach out to us on any of our social media platforms. Remember, you are the heart of Endow.